Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Yesterday marked the start of what is expected to be a significant week in U.S. domestic policy and presidential politics as the Supreme Court began releasing their decisions on this year's docket. Perhaps most notably was the court's decision in Arizona v. United States, in which the majority agreed with lower courts that three of the four provisions of Arizona's recently passed immigration law were preempted by federal immigration policy. The most closely watched decision is expected to come tomorrow, when the court will announce their decision on President Obama's landmark health care reform legislation, the ruling which could change the course of the 2012 presidential race. Joining me in the studio, and we're very proud to have him here to hear your take on these rulings and provide analysis, is Brad Hayes, assistant professor of political science at Union College and the man we like to call professor in residence here. Brad, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
It's great to be back on with you, Alan.
Okay. Give us a call, everybody. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Well, you know, Brad, I have taken three or four courses in my life in constitutional law and studied the Supreme Court and loved doing it, and I know that's a specialty of yours. But I have to say, in my opinion, I think that this group of people, I'm measuring my words, on the court, have brought the court to the lowest esteem in years. I think basically they have proven that they are just a partisan bunch of hacks. And Bush versus Gore and Citizens United and the rest. I think, you know, from my perspective, if anybody ever wanted a reason for not electing a president right now, a Republican, it would be that, you know, can you imagine nine of these guys on the court? Many of them that have been appointed by Republicans are relatively young, aren't they?
They are relatively young. And I mean, in terms of your take on the, you know, prestige and esteem of the court, you know, public opinion bears that out. The court is at a historic low in terms of where its public approval is. And, you know, it's really kind of stuck in the low 40s now. And it's been sliding down over time, particularly since Bush versus Gore, which you mentioned. So there does seem to be a real issue with the court in terms of its appearance with the public. And you know, it's interesting to consider that in light of what it's about to do with the Affordable Care Act, of whether in fact they decide to uphold this or whether they decide to strike down particularly the individual mandate provision.
What do you think is going to happen?
That's a good question. That's the million-dollar question. What we know is that oral arguments did not go well for the government.
No.
And in fact, there was really some interesting poll numbers before the oral arguments. Several of the former clerks were polled, and about 57% of them expected the Supreme Court to uphold the Affordable Care Act, particularly the individual mandate provision. After oral argument, that number dropped down to 35. Most of the clerks then expected the court to strike it down. So the oral arguments went particularly poorly. We also know that the kind of conservative machine, and I don't mean to use that in the sense of a conspiracy, but the right has been almost unanimous in its opposition to this individual mandate provision. The Republican Party has been unified in its opposition, but also conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, which actually came up with the very idea in the 1980s. They have come out and started essentially putting up briefs and white papers on
showing their true colors.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, you can see an ideological shift here. And so the right has been uniform in its opposition. And then that has had an effect on public opinion. So if you look at this, you know, this kind of packaging aspect, what it has done is it has in some ways freed up the court to decide either way. And that's where we get into the issue of policy preferences that you alluded to before.
Let's spend a little time. By the way, the telephone number here, if anybody wants to get in, is 1-800-348-2551. Now, Brad, I'll tell you what's going to happen. I've been around a long time. Happened yesterday. It'll happen today. Everybody will jump in at the last minute and say, why don't you take my telephone call? 1-800-348-2551. I'm telling you, people, if you want to get in, now's the time to do it. Brad, tell me about the Arizona case.
So in the Arizona immigration case, this was a 5-3 decision in which Justice Kennedy, who's often considered the kind of the median voter, that middle voter, the swing voter, wrote the decision for the majority and essentially barred Arizona from enforcing three of the key provisions of their immigration law. And they put off the decision on the constitutionality of the fourth provision. So the punchline, if you're trying to look for that, is that this was what many analysts are saying, a strong victory for the notion that immigration policy belongs to the federal government and not to the states, that in fact, states are preempted, which means that they're essentially kind of pushed out of legislating in that particular area. You know, in that sense, it seems like a big victory in some ways for the left and the Obama administration that decided to challenge the Arizona law in federal court. Yet there was one element that the court said, we're just not going to, you know, reach that decision. And that was on the, you know, kind of show me your papers provision, where the police in Arizona are effectively required when they make an arrest or have reason to believe an individual is an undocumented immigrant to hold that individual until they can check the legality of their presence in the country. So, you know, that's the big one, because many people have said that, look, that's going to lead to racial profiling. If someone looks like they're here illegally, they will be targeted. And that's profiling. What the court has said is that they may need to assess that once it's implemented. But right now, they didn't need to reach the merits of that particular decision. So when you go out to Arizona, the governor, Jan Brewer, said that it's a victory for us because that was the key provision. The Obama administration said, hey, it's a victory for us because most of the other provisions were knocked out.
I happen to think Brewer's right. I happen to think that she's right, that this last provision, the show me your papers, is really the key part of all of that. And, you know, I think Obama's right to say, you know, well, we won on three of the four, but that fourth is a killer. Let's go to Portia in Everett. Okay. Leverett. I'm so sorry. Portia, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, it's in Leverett, yeah. Massachusetts. Something that's really tremendously bothered me about the Citizens United ruling is that there's a difference between a corporation. They're, of course, they're people. It's absurd to argue that they're not. But they're people with one focus, and it's the economic focus. They've reduced their concerns to something that has to do with profit. They're economically oriented and motivated, whereas people like you and me, we are not corporations. We have multiple interests, and that's what the difference is. And when the Supreme Court gave equal standing to corporations, they were diminishing what human beings are capable of. And that's what's so alarming to me about it.
I love your analysis, except for one thing. When you say, of course, they're corporations, they don't fight, they don't eat. When we say, of course, they're corporations, they're individuals. I don't think they're individuals.
Of course, they're people, but as a corporation, they have one focus. They've reduced their focus to the bottom line.
Well, maybe I don't understand you, but I think what you're saying is, of course, they're people. They're not people. You mean they're made up of people?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I got
you. Oh, I don't think, yes. Oh, absolutely.
I don't think that's what the court said. The court said they're people.
Well,
the corporation itself is a people.
Well, I'll tell you, I think the Supreme Court is very diminished view of what human beings are.
Well, here's what I think. I think, and we'll let Brad, the expert, go, but I think what happens is in the power elite in this country, they just move the playing field every time the people get closer. So it's like Lucy in the football, you know, so I think that's what they did in this case. They just said, oh, by the way, we're going to let corporations control the electoral process now. And that's what the secret of that whole thing was. And I think that they're a bunch of people. I keep saying people instead of thugs. But go ahead, Brad. you have to go.
Yeah, I mean, Monday brought some kind of unfortunate news for those of us interested in seeing the Supreme Court revisit Citizens United, right, in the American tradition partnership versus Bullock case. They essentially basically ruled, with, by the way, without hearing oral arguments and without full briefing, that Citizens United is the rule of the law. And they struck down a 100-year-old Montana statute, which was, you know, it was just what it shows is that the court is simply not interested in reconsidering its decision. And what it does do is, I mean, this is in many ways going to shift the legal terrain now towards issues of disclosure, you know, as Congress begins thinking more about how you can kind of inject greater disclosure laws and how you can use existing FEC and IRS rules to force disclosure. There are going to be now be new legal challenges to those disclosure
laws. Unbelievable. Portia, we got to let you go, but thank you. And by the way, Portia, you were the first, but all five phones are now ringing.
Okay, good.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Bye.
Okay. We're going to go take a short break. We'll be right back. So Tom and RJ and Tom and whoever else, stay on the phone.
Support for WAMC comes from Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, thedamcafeandeli.com. Quality foreign car care, Ballston Spa, New York, sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, QFCC.com. Historic Huguenot Street, New Paltz, 18th century French settlement with Dutch-influenced stone houses, a reconstructed 1717 church, burial ground, guided tours, programs, and events through October, HuguenotStreet.org. Hudson Valley Footwear, Rhinebeck, footwear for the family, including Wolke sandals, Aurora Shoe Company sandals, and Keen sandals for women and kids, HudsonValleyShoes.com. And the Community Hospice, offering care and support to seriously ill nursing home residents and to patients who want to remain in their own homes, CommunityHospice.org.
RJ. And we're back. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, one free phone. Let's go to Tom in Claverack. Okay, Tom, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard on a program on the radio, it may very well have been on WAMC, within the past few years, that at that time there were over 500,000 undocumented Irishmen living in the Boston area with jobs, and that it has never been an issue and still isn't. I think that points out the racial aspect of the immigration problem in this country. And I don't think the problem is the Mexicans and the Central Americans coming here. I think the problem is the American people who are willing to employ them.
All right. Brad, do you want to take a crack at this?
Well, in terms of Massachusetts, it was interesting to see Governor Patrick's reaction, right? He said that, you know, this is, you know, that there would be no Arizona-type law while he's governor in Massachusetts, that, in fact, you know, Massachusetts is highly concerned about different aspects of policy related to profiling. And maybe it even taps into some other things about, you know, kind of the value of immigrants, both documented and undocumented, in the United States, and notions of fairness. And we might, in fact, find notions of fairness both in, you know, who these laws are being targeted against. And, you know, when, in fact, you begin, you know, looking at the law and the way it says, you know, that the police may suspect someone of being here in an undocumented fashion, you know, that kind of that in some ways fails that sniff test of profiling. So, you know, it may well be that different governors are going to evaluate this differently. And we see that in Massachusetts.
Well, Tom, what was years that you heard? Remember hearing this story about? Do you remember when the Irish first got here? Because they
I'd say that was about 2 years ago.
Yeah. But was it contemporary at that point? Because, you know, when the Irish first arrived here, they were treated like garbage. You know that. No Irish need apply and all the rest of that. So, you know, certainly at the time that the Irish immigration was here, they didn't get a free ticket at all.
No, that's not what I'm talking about at all. All I'm saying is today, the moment you talk about immigration, you're talking about somebody with dark skin from Central America or from Mexico. I would. Can you imagine the Boston police starting to pull over anybody who looks like they might be of Irish descent.
Yeah, you have to pull everybody over. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay, so let's go to RJ in Albany. RJ, we're trying to move it along here, so as quickly as you can. Go ahead.
Okay, based on the experience with the current Supreme Court, I would think that they would strike down the health care plan.
Right.
And I'm thinking that maybe that would be good, because maybe then people who want universal health care will be left with, you know, just a basic government health care plan like every other.
Okay, RJ, let's let our expert in first. Go ahead.
I think it's an interesting point in the sense that, you know, what this mechanism does is it forces individuals into the market, right? So yeah. In some ways, it's a market solution to the healthcare problem. And if, in fact, the court strikes that down, what's left is, you know, a dramatic expansion of a Medicare-type
program. Well, yes, and you certainly couldn't say that Medicare is unconstitutional because we already have it. Hey, RJ, good point. Thank you. Okay, let's go to Tom in Pittsfield. Tom, you're on.
Hello. I'd like to address Citizens United.
Okay.
And get the two professors' thoughts on the overruling of Montana's campaign law, which would say that states' rights are over, which is kind of funny since it's basically a Republican court. And secondly, if Citizens United says that a corporation is a person, why don't they pay personal income tax?
Why don't they fight? you know.
Why don't they get the death penalty, right?
Right. Why don't they get the death penalty? You know, you make a point. But, of course, Brad already did speak somewhat on the Montana decision. Why don't you give us a reprise of that?
Sure. I mean, when the court issued its decision in the American Tradition Partnership case, I mean, essentially it just solidifies the Citizens United ruling. And what's really, I think, particularly interesting here is that it was a 5-4 decision, and the four dissenting justices technically had the authority to force full review. There's something on the court known as the rule of four, in which four justices voting to hear a case forces the court to do so. But they didn't, and that seems to be a tacit acknowledgement that there is no chance that the majority will reconsider its position. And so for those, you know, looking to overturn Citizens United, you're really going to have to wait until such a time where there's personnel change on the court.
Yeah, which is why I think one can make the argument, if one is a Democrat, I'm an independent myself, that who you elect for president will have a great deal to do with the composition of the court, no matter what anybody says. And I had that fight with Ralph Nader once, and it was histrionic to be not so subtle. Tom, did you want to carry on?
I just wanted to pose those two questions to you.
Okay, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Bob in Cambridge. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Alan. Just a humorous note. I think this whole immigration situation could have been resolved way back about 300 or 400 years ago if the Iroquois and the Algonquin had set up their immigration and border patrol like everybody else should have. But, you know, it's sort of funny, this whole Supreme Court thing. It's going to go on like this until somebody dies on the Supreme Court, somebody, you know, retire, whatever. And there's no way to change it. And I think so many people are feeling helpless right now. It seems everything that is a populist movement, whether it be, you know, the movement against fracking, the movement to have people, you know, recognize as citizens and not corporations, it's just like we get nowheres, you know. And I don't know. I've heard a lot of people say, you know, what can we do? And I've even felt like calling up some of my elected officials like Bernie Sanders and saying, Bernie, what do we do? You tell us about what's going on, but what can we do, you know, besides calling up and talking to some intern in a congressman's office or a senator's office, and knowing that it's like that little button on the light at the crossing, right, which you push and you think the light's going to change immediately.
Okay. Bob, hold on a second. Yeah, let me go to Brad and ask you, Brad. FDR had a solution.
Yeah, he did have a solution. You know, this is really interesting because, you know, I mentioned some of the public opinion polling numbers on the Supreme Court in terms of approval. But when you ask people about life tenure and their support for life tenure, which I think is the core of Bob's frustration, this is an area that it's dropped off dramatically. At one point in time, this was perceived as untouchable, including if we're looking in the politics of the 1930s, where, you know, FDR goes up against the court and at least on one level, he loses, right? He doesn't actually get his court packing bill through. But, you know, this seems like it's a much more vulnerable issue. And if we look at other Western-style constitutional democracies, basically none of them have given their chief or their justices, their high court, life tenure.
So within that context, let me ask you this. As the court's approval goes down, do they react to that? Do they know it?
Yes. I think the answer to that is yes. I mean, the court historically has rarely stepped away from what is kind of the mainstream of political thought. It's rare that they deviate in a way or strike down something that's very popular. You know, and that in some ways, you know, I think is very much in line with the things that they did in the immigration case and what they may in fact do on Thursday when they release their decision on the Affordable Care Act, right? You know, in terms of the immigration case, about 52% of Americans said that the Arizona law is about right. And so you knock off a few provisions, you keep a couple more, and you see, in fact, how those play out, and you get a decision that's pretty consistent with where most people are.
And my feeling is that they knowing what was coming with the healthcare decision, they were probably sort of saying, "See, we're fair. We're fair."
It's possible. I mean, and it is interesting that both Kennedy and Roberts were in the majority in the Arizona versus United States.
Well, what do you think? Roberts is a swing vote?
Roberts, in fact, I mean, it's interesting because Roberts on the issue of federal power has, in fact, ruled in pretty comprehensive ways in the past. In fact, you know, supporting robust governmental authority. So some people say he's in play, you know, but, you know, again, it's really the issue of Kennedy. I mean, he seems to be the key in whether he could actually pull Roberts over.
And he's a libertarian.
On some issues, including the issue of governmental power, he trends towards libertarianism.
Yeah. Bob?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, even if you were going to dissipate this lifetime position in the Supreme Court,
yeah.
I mean, there's such gridlock in Congress, you know, between the filibuster and between, you know, the houses being controlled one part. So how would you even change it? I mean, right now, Bernie Sanders has a constitutional amendment up to define a person as, you know, a citizen as a person, not a corporation. But what are the chances of that getting through the Senate?
Zero.
And through Cooper? Yeah, zero. So this is why, you know, it's like, people say maybe they shouldn't be on there for life, but how do you change
it? Yeah, Brad?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Bob's frustration is right. It's very difficult to get an amendment through, but you can actually begin to think about the coalitions you could create, right? I mean, it's not like Republicans are lauding the court much these days. They still attack activist judges. The left is now very upset with the Supreme
Court.
With
activist judges, but in the wrong direction.
Well, that's right. But you can perceive a cross-partisan coalition forming on this particular issue. I mean, do I think it's going to happen anytime soon? No,
but you never know.
But I mean, sometimes a movement can, in fact, cobble together disparate elements in a way that we don't perceive when we think about conventional
politics. Bob, we got five people behind you. We're going to thank you for calling. And as always, thanks.
Bye. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Dick in Cobleskill. Okay, Dick, you're Wineskill. Dick, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I have basically three comments. The first is that I think the Citizens United decision was the worst since Separate but Equal and Dred Scott.
Okay. That's one, but only because I'm moving you along here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know, Alan. The second is when Roberts was being interviewed, he says that his job was like an umpire calling balls and strikes. And, of course, the Citizens United decision wasn't anything to begin with about corporations. And the third is a New Yorker cartoon showing somebody pleading their case in front of the Supreme Court, and the caption is, "If you prick a corporation, does it not bleed? If you tickle it, does it not laugh? If you poison it, doesn't it not die?" That's my comment.
Good comments. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's go to Chris in Albany. Chris, you're on.
Hi. Specifically, I guess, for Professor Hayes. I was reading the SCOTUS blog, I think, yesterday, and the article that I was reading kept referencing the Heller case and how the Heller case specifically said it's a right to have a gun in your house, but the Supreme Court says that it's up in the air on whether or not you can outside your house. And it specifically talks about how the court frames rulings and decisions for other courts to interpret them I guess, the different degrees of severity. It kind of leaves some things more open than other things that described other cases that this affected. And I was just curious if this court, with the more conservative justices, tends to issue more closed, I guess, concise rulings as opposed to more open rulings than other previous courts.
So, I mean, it actually kind of depends on the issue. It's an interesting question. So I think when you were talking about kind of the different levels of scrutiny that the court applies in the D.C. versus Heller case, which is the case that dealt with an individual's right to possess a firearm, certain localities, particularly urban localities like the District of Columbia and Chicago, had essentially created a ban on the ownership of handguns, or at least for all intents and purposes, there was a ban. And what the Supreme Court said was that there's a fundamental right to have a handgun or a firearm for traditional lawful purposes, and that this is a fundamental right. And when they recognize something as a fundamental right, they apply something that's known as strict scrutiny. And strict scrutiny is a very, very difficult test to pass for a statute. A state must show a compelling state interest, and they must show that the policy is essentially the least restrictive way of achieving a particular result. So that's a very high bar. So what the court has done, what this conservative court has done, is applied that to some areas where we haven't seen it before. They've done it for now corporate free speech. They've done it for guns. Those were areas that, you know, previously liberal courts did not apply it. So what we see actually is more of a kind of a shifting in the areas where the court is applying this the highest level of scrutiny. And that is really kind of the consequence of having a conservative versus liberal court.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. By the way, right now, all five phones have been busy. Now there's one little blinking phone, line number 4. So that means poor 1, 2, 3, and 5 are just very unhappy. You should make them happy and get on the phone, 1-800-348-2551. Because by the time James is done, and we don't know how fast that will be, we'll have nobody on the phone, and it'll just be Brad and me, and we'll have a nice conversation. Okay, let's go to James in Hudson. James, you're on.
I'll be quick about it.
No, don't be quick, because we need other people to call right now. So while you're filibustering, the other guys will be getting on the phone. Go ahead.
I don't believe in filibusters. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation, except for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I just want to say, this guy that came on with the anti-Irish thing, it's not because I'm Irish. This is, I'm American. But this is a nation of immigrants. And that's what made our country great. Immigrants. And letting in all people and this whole thing about secure borders and all this crap is just ridiculous. Because, who built the first transnational railway? The Irish and the Chinese. And they were despised equally. And I have, the situation we're in. It's, ridiculous that people say, America first, all this stuff. They're ridiculous, because that's the people who built this country, who, made it a great country, and I hope it will be again. Right now, it's not so great.
Okay, so let me ask you, James, don't go away yet. Let me just ask you this real quickly. So you don't think that the country has the right to limit the numbers of people who come into the country? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, we can only take so many people, but I don't think we should discriminate. I think, we actually, brought in, black people to build this country. Yep. Who did a lot of the hard work. And we also, not my family was busy being killed by the English, but I'm an Anglophile, and I love the Queen, and I love, Britain. But, But they, we brought in black people to build this country and Irish and Chinese, and all of a sudden now we don't have room anymore. I think, anyone that has some kind of qualification should come in here, because it's a great country and we need those people.
Well,
it's true.
I mean, it's true. As a matter of fact, I just heard, Brad, I don't know if you heard the same thing, or James, if you heard it, that there is more out-migration among Mexicans in the United States right now than in-migration, which is fascinating.
And I talked to one of my best friends who helped me through got so many things, and he's living in Mexico now. He just moved because it's less expensive to live here, but he's, you know, he did built, you know, this wonderful business that I worked for, and he's, you know, I mean, God bless him and keep him. And I don't believe in God, but, you know, God bless him if she exists.
James, thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much. Yeah.
Okay, cheers.
Yeah. Bye. Okay, we'll go to Tony in Saugerties. Tony in Saugerties, you're on.
Hi, I'm Tony from Saugerties.
That's what
I'm
I just said. Irish, go ahead.
Yes. I'm an Irish immigrant. I'm a naturalized citizen. But in reference to previous comments, in my opinion, Kennedy Airport is the biggest port of entry in the United States for all immigrants. Queens is the new Ellis Island. There are 147 nationalities living in Queens with 174 dialects. There's an underground economy that's worth billions. These people come here to work. They're willing to pay taxes. They use the schools. They use the. I know all this information firsthand. I was in the bar business. I hope I don't get arrested. But that's where people cash their checks, their payroll checks. They work as nurses.
Okay. So your point is, to sum it all up in a single sentence, your point is that immigrants are major contributors to the country, which I think we all agree with. And is there something else?
This law in Arizona is racial profiling.
Of course.
They're
okay.
Picking on one group of people. I don't know why. They work just as hard as anybody else. They do work that other people don't want to do. They work for half of what people would do it for. They're an asset to the country. They want to be a better life. Their children will be good citizens.
Okay.
The Supreme Court is pathetic.
You've made a contribution, Tony. Appreciate it very much.
Law and justice are two different things.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Couldn't agree more on that. 1-800-348-2551. Listen, if your name is Ned or Mark or Ron or anything else, just hang in there. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from SPAC, presenting the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra July 25th with conductor Joanne Folletta and Michael Ludwig Violin performing Smetana, Mozart, and Dvorak, sponsored by First Niagara, SPAC.org. Adventure Outfitters, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering outdoor clothing, camping equipment, cross-country skis, snowshoes, climbing equipment, canoes, and kayaks, open evenings until 9. AdventureOutfitter.com. New York State tobacco-free community partners working to reduce youth and adult smoking rates across the state and help save lives. New York State tobacco-free community partners at smokefreecapital.org. Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Serving the greater capital region, Glens Falls, Saratoga, and the Berkshires, interimhealthcare.com. And the Hudson River Valley National Heritage Area, partnering with 100 heritage sites to interpret and preserve the cultural and natural resources of the Hudson River Valley. HudsonRiverValley.com.
Okay, everybody, we are back with Professor Brad Hayes, an expert on the Supreme Court. We're taking your calls. We're interested in what you have to say. However, we're coming to the end of the program, so if you want to say it fast. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Ned in New Marlborough. Ned, you're on.
Yeah, I just have a comment on the Supreme Court. I think that... the members of the Supreme Court should not be allowed to be a member of any political party. I think they should have to be independent, which, and I know it's kind of hard to really, you know, enforce something like that. But
yeah, how would you do it? How would you do it? I mean, you know, the fact is all citizens have a right to vote, and they can be in political parties, number one. And number two, even if you got them all to formally renounce their political party, you know, as well as I do, that they would be who they are and why they were appointed in the first place, right?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it just seems like as long as, you know, you have members of a party, you know, they're beholden to a political party in there, you really can't get a truly... fair and just and independent decision from them.
Okay, well, that's right. You got a proposal?
Not really. It's just a comment, and I wish I had a better
No, that's
way
okay,
to make
Ned.
It happen,
that's but. Okay. I mean, you know, as Brad Hayes has said, you got to have a constitutional amendment to change all of this, and that's one of the hardest things you could possibly do. But you know, I think things do change. I think we've got a worldwide climate right now, which is very iffy. I think the concept of recession, depression, as a result of what's going on in the European theater and the rest of it, even in China, is not out of the question. And that's when you see massive change in politics, when things like that happen. Ned, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Mark in Kingston. You're on, Mark. Go.
Hi. A couple of comments. The first is a follow-up on the immigration issues that they just decided, the local laws on immigration. The first thing is that I don't understand why people don't protest restriction on immigration as a violation of free trade, since the movement of labor across borders should be as kept as free, I think, as the movement of capital across borders. Otherwise, there's a distortion, a market distortion that results there inevitably. Mm. So that's one thing, and then that would put those kind of laws conceivably in conflict with our international free trade agreements, I would guess. At least the spirit of them, if not the word of them. But that's sort of, that's aside. I'm wondering if your guest could talk a little bit more about the decision that's coming up on the health care bill.
Okay, that's a good idea.
And how the commerce clause is going to play into that decision.
Okay, that's a good idea, Mark. And we're trying to move it along. So Brad, if you'd keep it short, that would be great. And we'll go to the next guy.
Sure. The individual mandate provision that's in the Affordable Care Act is premised off of Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, which states that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states. So what that means is that you have to tie in the regulation to commercial activity. What conservatives have argued is that you're not regulating activity, you're regulating non-activity, the decision to not enter a marketplace, which is the decision to not purchase insurance. The other side, of course, is arguing that by deciding not to enter the market, you are affecting the market, because when you go in for emergency care, you just shift the cost from you to the state and insured consumers. And so the left is essentially saying this is very clearly commerce and commercial activity, whereas the right is saying this is non-activity.
Also, I think we should remember that the Congress had a hell of a time taking jurisdiction over health care in the first place. And in the Senate, interstate and foreign commerce became the first committee that was considering health care, because it went across state lines. An interesting proposition.
Yeah.
That sort of is the justification for health care coming under the Commerce Clause.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the insurance market's clearly interstate commerce.
Sure.
And the markets affect, across the nation, so across states. So in some ways, there's really only a question about whether the activity is actual activity, and whether, in fact, once you view this kind of thing as forcing people into the marketplace, whether there's any real limitation on federal power.
Mark, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Okay, can I just ask a question that's related to that?
Yeah.
Can we say something about how the swing votes are likely to come down on that particular issue, given their voting on Commerce Clause?
Do you have your crystal ball here, Brad?
I left that at home. It's a very good question. Kennedy, in the past, as well as Roberts, have voted in favor of less sweeping exercises of congressional authority. But really, there is no directly analogous case. It's simply a question of whether, in fact, the court wants to go against a significant line of precedent, case law dating back to about 1937, or whether, in fact, they want to vote to restrict economic activities based on a case that was decided in 1992, Lopez versus United States.
Mark, there you go. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Let's go to James and Monroe. That would be James Monroe. James,
yeah, I was just wondering about the separation of powers, like in a Senate or in a Congress, or even presidents, they can impeach Is there anything, and why not, about the Supreme Court?
Because sure, sure. Wait, James, only because we want to move on. Okay. The Supreme Court, members of the Supreme Court can be impeached, yes.
Well, I think that's what we ought to do.
Well, tell it to the guys in the Senate who can't get a bill passed because the things are so close.
Okay.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it. Let's go to Daniel in Rosendale. Okay, Daniel in Rosendale, you're on.
Hey, how are you? I just got a comment about the immigration reform. They're passing all these things and, you know, doing it, making it harder for people who naturalize here. I came from Germany when I was about, you know.
Daniel, could you speak? Could you get a little closer to the phone? It's a little tough to hear you.
I came from Germany when I was about 4 years old, and it is next to impossible for me right now. I've been fighting the immigration system for 14 years, and I still can't do anything. I'm being sponsored by, a retired staff sergeant in the military, and I still can't get anything done.
Okay, what's the question? What's the question?
Why are they making it harder instead of easier for, people that aren't a threat to the country?
That's a good question. I mean, in cases like the Arizona versus the United States, and this is not going to be directly responsive to your question, but they're really assessing who has the power. Is this something that the federal government has or whether the state government has? And, their answer here was largely that the federal government has the power. Now, that means that it has the power to create the kinds of rules that it thinks are best. And what I think your experience is saying is that the rules, in fact, could be better. But those are different types of questions.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it, James. That's not James, is it? Who was Daniel?
Daniel.
Maybe? I don't know. Okay, that was Daniel. Let's go to Jeff in Clifton Park. Jeff in Clifton Park.
Hi. I've just got a comment and a question on Judge Scalia's dissent in the immigration decision.
Yeah.
It seems that he's dropped all pretense of objective legal analysis and is just drafting a political screed. And I was kind of shocked, and I'm wondering if it was unprecedented for a Supreme Court justice to use an opinion of the court to directly respond to a comment by a president at a presidential press conference. He seemed to be actually engaging in a political debate through his dissent, and I'm wondering if they've ever seen him be that snarky before.
Not at this level. Now, if we go back in Supreme Court history, we see more examples of this. But recently, the court is not engaged in that kind of partisan bickering. I mean, and you're right. Scalia's dissent was almost like a talking points memo from the right. Clearly, and from the bench and in his decision, he criticizes the recent announcement by the Obama administration to suspend deportation of young undocumented immigrants who came to the United States as children and, have been here and abided by the law and entered college and or the military. And so he's basically said that this is ridiculous and it's poor policy. And that is extremely unusual. And in some ways, Scalia is, a bit out of the kind of normal comfort zone for the court. But that was one interesting aspect of his dissent and unusual. The other one is that, I mean, in terms of his legal justification, he basically said states are true sovereigns and they get to control who enters their boundaries. And basically, this was a historical argument about kind of residual sovereignty. But that's very much out of line with contemporary legal thought. So it was a really strange dissent, and no one joined it. It was his dissenting opinion alone, and I think the other members of the court were quite uncomfortable with it.
Well, it's bad when he can't get his lapdog Clarence Thomas to join the dissent.
Thank you, Jeff. Let's go to Bob in Saratoga. Bob, you're on.
Yes, I'd just like to say I quickly wanted to respond to a point that someone said that, well, why are we making it tough for immigrants and that we allow people in the mm-hmm. path?
Yeah.
But, I mean, somewhere you have to have some limits because you're going to have 200 million Chinese move in to this country. And where would wages, what would the country become? And essentially be an invasion through immigration. And now I don't want to dwell on that point, but I did also disagree with the fact that corporations are people. And as soon as we figure a way to basically destroy, take a corporation apart, give it the equivalent of a death sentence, we need to really start treating corporations as people, putting the officers in jail, et cetera, And, that's just my point of view.
No, I was just going to say I'm glad you made that point of view. Appreciate it very much. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah. You're welcome. Bye.
Okay, let's go to Curtis in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Curtis, you're on.
Just a quick question. I realize the Supreme Court justices obviously have different parties they favor and so on that put them on the court. But what would happen if, for example, a certain justice would make a surprise ruling, which they would surprise their party, and it would go the other way? Would they get a tongue lashing?
Let me start on that, Curtis, and then we'll go to the true expert here. This, of course, has happened many times in the past in this country on the Supreme Court. Justices who were not supposed to behave in a particular way, the great Earl Warren being probably the prime example. Eisenhower was said to have said, the worst mistake I ever made, putting him on the court. He turned out to be one of the great true liberals in the history of this country. And Eisenhower, that wasn't what he was bargaining for. Brad?
Yeah, no, and that's right. And it's just one of those things that there are surprises from time to time. But for the most part, these people are vetted, fairly well. And particularly, there have been some kind of institutional reforms that presidents have enacted dating back to Reagan that have in some ways minimized the opportunities for a surprise. Now, perhaps Souter is an exception to that. Mm. But otherwise, there are many different kind of networks that exist that are feeding conservative jurists to the right and liberal jurists to the left. And while, someone may step out of the norm in a discrete case, for the most part, you're going to get liberal presidents appointing liberal justices and conservative presidents appointing conservative justices.
Perhaps you could tell Curtis a little about the cult of the robe.
The cult of the robe is a completely different thing. I mean, that has to do quite a bit with the esteem of the court and the ways in which judges see themselves in this particular role. And, some of that also, speaks to kind of the kind of cultural influences on justices as well, the way that they perceive the court in American culture, but also the ways in which they see the court affecting that culture as a whole. So that's,
I would differ a little bit on the interpretation. It's always been my understanding is once that guy puts the robe on or that woman puts the robe on, they're a different person. They don't owe anybody anything. I think we've now seen that that really doesn't work. Clarence Thomas, they knew what they were getting and they got it.
Yeah, and I mean, life tenure certainly shores that up. I think it was Ned who said that, that they're beholden to party. Well, life tenure was created to get them out of that. Mm-hmm. And so as a consequence, you end up having, long durations for Supreme Court tenure.
Let's go to Cliff. Thanks, Curtis. Let's go to Cliff. And by the way, there's nobody else on the line. So after that,
Hello.
And me. Go ahead.
Hi. In reflecting on what you're saying, I think that part of the problem we're talking about reflects an imbalance in the checks and balances. What we frequently see happening is 5-4 decisions declaring statutes unconstitutional. So you have Congress, who has a duty to decide whether a statute is constitutional or not, passing a statute, and 4 Supreme Court justices who say it is constitutional. And yet it's declared unconstitutional because 5 are against it. I think, much like the supermajority required in the Senate, a needed reform is to say that in a close case like that, where it's not clearly unconstitutional, where you have Congress and 4 justices of the Supreme Court saying a statute is constitutional, that the Supreme Court should lack the power to declare it unconstitutional. A supermajority of the
okay,
Supreme
but Cliff, let me respond by saying should schmud. I mean, the fact of the matter is this is the way it is. Now, how are you going to change it? I agree with you, but how are you going to change it?
Well, that's the question I've been grappling with. Obviously, one way to change it would be through a constitutional amendment. Difficult to do, perhaps the best way to do it. The other question
perhaps
I have,
impossible. Yeah.
The other question I have for your expert, and I don't know the answer to this, is that since Congress has the authority under the Constitution to define the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, could Congress legislate the necessity of a supermajority to declare acts of Congress? unconstitutional.
The expert will tell you absolutely not.
Right. And yeah, and they couldn't. There have been struggles about who has the right to define certain aspects of the Constitution, particularly the 14th Amendment. Those battles have manifested between Congress and the court, and the court has basically said, no, we control that. Congress can't in some ways set the way we'll go about our constitutional duties. But I do think it's actually an interesting point in the sense that, you know, when Roberts was appointed, he said that consensus should be the norm and that he was going to work at building consensus. Right. And so, you know, you even hear justices talk about it as being important. But once, in fact, they get on the bench, there's almost no incentive for consensus. And, you know, as a consequence, you know, we seem to get a lot of 5-4 decisions.
Hey, Cliff, that's it. Sorry about that, old friend. And thank you to Bradley from Richmond, who is not going to get on the air today because we are out of time. I do apologize to Bradley, who is on the air, not Bradley, who is here with us, Brad Hayes. Thanks to Brad Hayes for joining us today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Fleet Feet Sports, Colony, New York, footwear and apparel for runners, walkers, and triathletes, offering coached training programs for all distances, all abilities, fleetfeetalbany.com, and Mother Earth Storehouse, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Saugerties, natural food and vitamin centers serving the Hudson Valley with organic and natural food since 1978, MotherEarthStorehouse.com. And Brattleboro, Vermont, offering a wide variety of recreational cultural experiences in a small town New England setting, BrattleboroChamber.org, and Shakespeare and Company welcoming Split Knuckle Theater's physical theater comedy Endurance through July 15th, Shakespeare.org. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Melissa Wednesday Bunning. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Chartok. On tomorrow's program, it's Bets and Vets with Dr. Ron Scharf. Stay tuned now for a news update.